You're Ramsey Harbourkeeper, of course, Tony. And so tell us about your day-to-day. You've got the jumper on there as well.
Yes, I have. Yeah, I'm literally just popped out from work to do this. So Ramsey, harbourkeeping in general is quite a varied job. No 2 days are the same. And each of the harbours has their own little team. Mm-hmm. And we're specifically Ramsey. And we have, obviously... various other things that we do in Ramsey that the other harbours don't do. For instance, we have the Ramsey Swing Bridge. Mm-hmm. We have commercial vessels coming in and out with Mezeron, and they come in at any time of the day or night, depending on the tide. Mm-hmm. So we would be expected to take the lines and guide them in, swing the vessels. And then, if it's at 2 o'clock in the morning, you would then spend a couple of hours maybe a couple of hours doing that. Then you'd need to go home to bed, get some sleep, and then be back down for your core hours of 8 till 4. So it is quite an exciting job, really. Yeah. And Ramsey's quite a big footprint.
How long have you been doing that for, Tony?
Well, the actual harbour keeping, not long. I would say 3 years.
Right.
But in the harbours department, I was before in the sea terminal, and I was a senior watch officer up there. So that's a 24/7 job, if you like.
Big job.
Because you've got emergency Coast Guard, and you've got, obviously, you are the focal point for dealing with all the marine operations. It's called the Marine Operations Centre. And I spent 9 years there. And then, due to one thing or another, I thought a position came up within the harbours department as a whole. And Ramsey's where I live. Nice. So I thought, well, you know, I'm 64 now. So I thought I would have a go at that. And it's been great. It's there's a lot of outdoor aspect to it, which I like. And as I said, no 2 days are the same.
And one thing I'm gathering about you, Tony, is you like spending a lot of time around water and a lot of time around ships as well. Is that always been the case throughout your life?
Yes. My father was very keen on boating. When my sister and I were young, we used to water ski in the Tyne because that's where we originally came from. Came back over to the island in 1974. Mm-hmm. And... my dad brought his ski boat over then, and he got into sailing. And during the hot years of 75, 76, the 76 drought year, I was a teenage boat boy at the Moorwick Boat Park.
Right.
So that was my background from Ramsey. Yeah. Always had an affinity with Ramsey, and that's obviously where I consider home.
Yeah. And, well, that leads us up to where you are now. And you've had a pretty epic adventure, I think it's fair to say. This this was last year. You went across over the Atlantic. And tell us what led to you being involved on this trip.
Well, it's sort of crept up on me, if you like. It's always been something I've thought about. Because I've sailed since I was 12, basically. And I've owned several boats myself. For the real sailors out there, they would consider I was a weekend sailor, which is fair enough, which, you know, we go for local ports, sailed a lot of ports in the Irish Sea. I've chartered in the Med and generally been involved with boats for a long time. So the ultimate for me was to do something much more out of that sphere.
Okay.
And the Atlantic to cross an ocean was really almost an impossible dream to start with. And then... working within the Isle of Man government, and in particular within the harbours, they're quite keen to progress you, and you can apply for special leave, which will give you time out to do something because you'd need the time outside your normal leave period to do that. And basically, to summarise it, all the doors I expected to be closed in my face were actually open. I did a tentative inquiry last year. My line manager seemed very keen, and so did the director. So they said, well, you know, it's a winter time. We would be happy for you to do this. And it's a harbour's nautical thing. And so that was open. And then probably the other way round to what I'm going to say now, I had to ask my other half.
Of course. Well, that's where I was thinking, Tony.
Yeah, exactly. Probably Yeah, I did that first, to be fair. and then approached work about it. And right. I said, work were fantastic on this. And yeah, the other half took in a deep in breath.
Yeah.
But she knows my passion for all this. Mm-hmm. She knows that it's probably going to be a one-off. And she's fully supportive. She said, right, you've got a chance now. Yeah. Who knows what's going to happen in a year? Let's just roll with the dice.
Yeah.
And that's what suddenly what was going to be a distant goal was, you know, it's going to be realistic now, mm-hmm. because I'm not getting any younger. And I thought, well, I've got to do it while I'm reasonably fit.
Yeah.
And that's what led up to the actual signing on for the ARC, which is a good and a safer way of crossing the Atlantic as for a first timer as you can possibly get, really.
Yeah. So tell us about the route that you took then. Started in Gran Canaria?
Yes, it did. Yeah. The ARC's an Atlantic rally for cruisers. And it's been on the go since 1986. And since then, up to the present day, there's been about 8,000 vessels mm-hmm. that have done that. Right. So it's a well-documented event. And it does start in Gran Canaria, as you quite rightly say. So we go down to Gran Canaria, and you have a few days to prep the boat. The boat was from a local area, actually. Well, local in the greater scheme of things for the Isle of Man, up in the Clyde in Scotland.
Okay.
Go West Sailing. They're a charter company. They do a lot of chartering around the Irish Sea generally. And this was their first Atlantic. They had a really good skipper on board who'd done the Atlantic several times, but with Go West, this was their first one.
Okay.
So, seven strangers.
I was going to say, you didn't know the crew before
know the crew at all. I mean, you can do this arc in various ways. You can be young, fit, and very good at sailing and come down and say, I'm young, fit, and good at sailing. How about, would you need some extra crew? Mm. And you get on board, and that's the way they do it. You can see people walking around with placards around their neck saying what their qualifications are. And even if it's, I'm a fantastic chef, that would probably get you on board on some of these boats.
Yeah, we'll come back to that point later in the conversation. Yeah. But that must have been quite daunting as well, putting yourself forward like that.
It was, yeah, because the only other way you can really do it is have your own boat and sail down there. But you have to get it coded up to quite a level. Mm. The time off required for that would be quite phenomenal, to getting it from these waters down to there and then prepping it and then going through the process of mm-hmm. being checked. So the final area which I'd looked at and had been recommended as a good place to start is to actually pay for a berth on board a boat as an active crew.
Okay.
And so that's what I did. And I looked at a couple of sites, and Go West being near us, I thought, wow, this will be the place to start. Yeah. And they had a slot for me. They were all excited because this is their first Atlantic themselves. So a crew from Go West sailed it down probably September, October time down to Gran Canaria. And we all flew out from different parts of the UK and beyond to join the boat. And that's where we all met up, basically. Yeah. I met the skipper, first of all. There's a place called Sailor's Bar, which is in Gran Canaria, where it's a focused hub. It's right, leads onto the pontoons. Everybody meets there. And so you've got a real vibe.
Sailor's Bar sounds like a good place to break the ice.
Yeah, it does. Fantastic. And there's so much going on. There's all these boats. They're all looking at their watches, thinking, I've got to get this done. This is broken. This needs attention. And the sort of energy within the place is quite something.
Yeah.
And we had our own issues to sort out, which was good. And then you get to know everybody, get given your watches and everything else.
And then not before long after that, you're then out on the sea. So tell us how this voyage went.
Yeah, the start just before we left, we had we didn't know we were going to have one of these on board, but we had what they call a water maker, which is what it sounds like. It converts salt water into fresh water, so the pressure of holding water tanks is not so high, and we were told we had one of these on board, brand new, and a generator. To actually fire it up, because it's quite heavy on the juice. Unfortunately, the thing didn't work.
Right.
They'd fired it up on shore power, so it had all the power, you know, the electric from the shore. But once it tried to manage its own generator, could have been settings, could have been something. The engineers were desperately trying to sort it, but they couldn't. So the long and short of it is that we just, right, we haven't got one of these. Yeah. We didn't intend to have one of these to start with. Mm-hmm. So the water we had and the provisions that we had were what we have and nothing else.
Yeah.
So we re-provisioned the boat with this in mind. And then, of course, that leads us to the start that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And the start, they had a big naval boat out in the bay.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a race section to the whole event, which the race section are under race orders. They cannot use the engine. They have to rely solely on sails, and they're positioned accordingly to the race ethic.
Hmm.
We all started as though we were in a race. So you have a 10-minute gun, a 5-minute gun, and then the off, and you've got this vast flotilla. Mm-hmm. The race section goes first. They have their own, so it clears them out of the way and they're not tripping up over us or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're gone. You realise that the last untying of a knot on the pontoon was, in fact, the last one you're going to do until you get to the Caribbean.
Wow.
And that sort of psychs you out a bit.
I can imagine, yeah. Because, and like you say, you're setting off altogether, and you must hit a point where it's just nothing but water. What was that moment like?
Yeah, you're quite right. We were all together. So we set off at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and all the excitement of close handling with other boats nearby. But quite soon, even within the period of the afternoon into the early evening, the boats are already spreading out. So I suppose that first night, we had to be quite watchful because boats could be tacking across your path, mm-hmm. and you still have to remember the racing rules and general seamanship. But then when you got into 2 days, I would say probably two days in, you wouldn't actually see another boat, possibly 3 days. You knew they're there because you had the AIS, the identifying system, and you had radar and what have you, although we didn't actually have radar on board our boat, but we had the AIS, and you could see all the signals on the various boats. And you also had Starlink on board, so which a lot of other vessels in the past haven't had that luxury.
Sure.
So we were able to plug into the internet, see where people were and what they were doing. But from the third day onwards, you are on your own. And that feeling of just the vastness of the ocean, I mean, this is what I wanted more than anything, to experience the vastness of something that makes you very small and very aware of your position in the world. And from a sailing point of view, that was great. You'd think that with seven people on board, you're never going to get that sort of alone feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, that's true. But there was times when you could just sit and look at it.
Yeah.
And it was forever changing as the ocean does.
What was that like, looking out from the boat at nothing but ocean?
Nothing. Yeah, it was... it was quite awe-inspiring, really, and the daylight, the strong daylight in the good weather that we had at times, brings the ocean alive with colour, very deep, deep blue, and it really it's hard to explain. I mean, one of the things that I focused on was trying to look into the far distance, and you'd see what, if it had been land, you would see with the scale of it, it'd be like a distant peak or something like that you'd be looking at. But of course it's sea, so it's not. It's a big wave. And they would crest, and you'd get this curling of white water, which we all know as white horses.
Sure.
But I got to feel that that's why they call them white horses, because out there they actually look like horses cresting over, whereas here they're a lot shallower and a lot closer to each other. But out there they would just spring out of nowhere. And that emphasised the vastness for me anyway. Mm.
I imagine an absolutely beautiful sight, but also quite daunting as well. Because you had some incidents with some quite rough waters out there.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I think it's fair to say, we all felt a slight anxiety level building when darkness fell, because especially when we were in quite a lot of wind, we were up to 25, topping at 30 when the scores came through. And so you had reduced head sales. I mean, don't get me wrong, this wasn't all the time. I mean, there were some calm patches as well, which again had its issues because we were going too slowly. And we motored in areas that we could, always to be mindful of the fact that we've got dwindling fuel supplies.
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, the biggest incident that happened to me was during a night watch. So they split us all into watches, and we were two people on a watch at a time. And it would probably be it was coming up to the middle watch, was midnight till four, the graveyard shift. And I'd been on the previous watch, and the sea would have been quite rough. And the strange thing about the roughness of a sea, you're getting chucked about all over the place. But you don't. The sea doesn't feel rough. It's hard to comprehend. I think it's because you've been chucked around for so much for so long, you don't actually recognise it anymore.
Kind of balance
it
out.
It does. Suppose, you don't feel. You think, oh gosh, if I was out on a normal day, I'd feel a bit queasy here. Not at all. You just don't. And so that was good. But leading to that incident, it was probably coming up to midnight. And we'd had fairly rough sea, as usual, boats going to and fro, pitching as well as sort of yawing. And I can remember being on the leeward side of the boat, which is basically you've got the windward side, which is tipping the boat over, and where the wind's coming over the side of the boat. And you got the leeward side, which is the opposite end. So if the sails are in tight, the boat is leaning towards the leeward as the boat is pushed over. So we had two helming positions. I was on the leeward side, so I was quite near the water. Mm-hmm. And up on the windward side was my friend and colleague sharing my watch. And he was tucked up underneath a big canopy. So obviously being dark, you're hearing noises more amplified. I can remember hearing a thud on the windward quarter. So that was the opposite side to where I was, and the quarter being the stern section of the boat, but not the stern. Mm. So it was a big slap and a thud. And the rest of it really I got afterwards from my crew member, from my watch member, who saw it all happen because he was looking down on it. Mm. And basically he said that he'd heard the same thud, looked up, and this great big wave had hit the side of the hull, and in doing so jacked itself up above the cockpit. And at the same time, the sea that we were sailing through was building along the side of the boat, so it joined the wave, doubling its volume, and then it crashed into the cockpit, not touching the other guy at all. You just saw it dump this large volume, which basically filled the cockpit area. Mm-hmm. And all I can remember is being underwater.
Right.
I was holding onto the helm position, and the next thing, I was underwater being pushed with the force of the wave. We're all clipped on with harnesses.
Yeah.
So had my hand grip come undone, I would still be tethered. Only problem was that minutes later, we were changing watch, so you'd have to untether in that moment.
It would have been that moment, yeah.
And the wave came over the top, and it ripped off and fractured the bracket that held our safety gear and took that out into the night, along with the life buoy light, which marks your position if you're a man overboard. And that just disappeared off.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite interesting.
to say the least.
To say the least. And as I was sort of spluttering with water, I mean, I'm making it sound like it was ages underwater, but it couldn't have been more than seconds. But it was definitely, you were completely under.
Yeah.
And the next big thing was a bang as your life jacket inflated, which it's designed to do if it actually goes underwater. So the force of the water was such to make it believe that it had gone beneath the surface of the water. And that was really quite something.
You mentioned your other half earlier in the program.
Yeah, sure.
What does she make of it when you say these stories, when you told her about this incident?
Yeah, it's funny you should say that because we had Starlink, so I was WhatsApping her when I could get the chance.
Yeah. Talk now, I'm underwater.
Yeah, I can't talk now. It's a bit of a bubbly sound. But no, you'd be talking about what had happened, and then you'd get to this section of your text, and it would come back, frigging hell. No way. Are you sure you were properly strapped on? Well, yes, it's okay. Well, everybody's fine because, of course, they're just getting it sort of secondhand.
Of course, yeah.
And they can give it arms and legs and believe, you know, there's a lot more. But it must be difficult being at the other end of the phone because you don't know what's going on. But she was very stoic about it, very into it because she's a sailor herself. She's not hasn't done a lot of sailing, but she's done a lot of sailing with me, and she. She'll say, "Oh, I'm not a sailor," but she actually knows a lot about boat handling. If you put her on a boat, she's really quite good, but suffers really badly now from seasickness.
You had some other incidents on your way to St. Lucia, didn't you? Tell us about what happened with the Marlin.
Oh, yeah. Now, the Marlin's an interesting one because all the boats try and supplement their fairly limited diet with anything they can catch fresh. So people have rods out and... Bearing in mind, we're not in the race category, we're in the cruising category. We're there to experience the crossing, not to beat the hell out of ourselves to get there and be half alive when you get to the other end. Not that sort of thing. So fishing is perfectly normal. And we actually caught this Marlin with a hand line.
Right.
Now, this is not the sort of general store hand line, which is a little wooden thing that you wrap orange cord around.
Yeah,
for crabs and things. No, it's nothing like that. It's a massive, almost like an inner tire of a car in miniature version, and it had thick translucent line wrapped all the way around it. So you sent this out with weighted squid type bait.
Right.
And sometimes we'd catch things, and sometimes we wouldn't. But on this particular occasion, the line went from being horizontal across the surface of the water to diving straight down, and we were hauling it in, and as it got closer there was a thrashing of white water as this what must have been a large fish was getting near the surface, and we finally got it in to the stern of the boat and hauled it up, and it just kept coming. It was 2 meters in length with a great big sword type nose to it.
Intimidating.
We hung it over the sugar scoop stern that we had and kept it out of the cockpit, and we had a guy who's done quite a lot of that style fishing, and he had a loop of cord that he kept handy, so when it came out you put this loop of cord, which is basically a slip knot, around the tail, which then gripped it hard, and then you lashed it up so that it hung down. And then you had to obviously euthanize it as quickly as you could because you couldn't afford that thing into the cockpit jumping about all over the place. And once you're absolutely sure that it wasn't going to be making any other moves, we then hauled it on board and literally filleted it. First meal was within an hour of the catch. And then the next we just froze. We had a freezer on board.
But that's as fresh as it gets,
isn't it? It's as fresh as it gets.
What was that taste like?
Unbelievable. In fact, that night, which wasn't quite as fresh, we had some of us had it raw because somebody knew a recipe for like a sushi type thing.
As you do.
Yeah, as you do. And they squirted lemon on it and you had it raw, and it was like a steak, a fish steak. It was made into cubes, and it was lovely. Yeah, if somebody had asked me, "Would you like some of this?" I'd have said no.
Yeah.
But having tasted it, and we let it last throughout, we'd add it to the various other dishes that we had.
So, how long were you out there on the Atlantic for, Tony?
In total, 3 weeks. Yeah. So that was 3 weeks without seeing anybody else apart from our little world, and obviously. There are documented periods when you've got so many people in a small space of a boat, and you can't go anywhere. You can't escape. So the biggest documented thing is personality clashes.
Sure,
you've got to all work really hard to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, how do you keep morale up?
You keep morale up by obviously biting your tongue a lot, and they obviously bite their tongues in. You work together for everything, and that breaks down a lot of ice. And our watches were also our paired up sections for doing duties. So you'd have two people put together, and two people put together, and two people put together. So we had three lots of two, and then the skipper was a seventh person. And he wouldn't be in any of the rotors or anything because he needed to walk between the rotors, if you like. And he said to us, he said, "You're all going to have moments where you're going to get had enough of each other. And you just have to work your way through that There were some boats that we heard tales of. When they got there, they just all jumped ship once they got to the Caribbean.
Never want to see you again.
No, exactly. And there were bits like that, but we were a really good crew. We were very varied. Yeah. We ranged from 70 years old through to probably the youngest being mid-50s.
Right.
So we were definitely the last of a summer wine group.
But once in a lifetime experience, absolutely. And what was that moment like when you saw St. Lucia and the Caribbean on the horizon?
Yeah, unbelievable, because obviously we were tracking with electronics where we were, and we knew that we were due that day to arrive in St. Lucia. And we were all sort of scanning the horizon. And it just very, very faintly appeared in the distance. It looked like a bit of the cloud formation, but it was only when you hung on to that outline that it became more distinct. And the water was absolutely glorious, in the way of its colour,
of course, the sea.
And it was obviously getting lighter because we were lighter in colour of the water, because we weren't no longer in deep Atlantic. And seeing that the forestation and everything like that on the land, we hadn't seen anything like that for... I hadn't seen anything like that before anyway, but land generally for 3 weeks. And the reception we got was unbelievable. I mean, you know, it wasn't like we were first, we were way down the fleet. Mm. But when we got in there, they had a big boat at anchor with all the flags flying, and then a buoy set off. So that was your finish line.
Yeah.
So you crossed that. And they basically read out on a tannoy that... Do not underestimate this achievement. You have done so many nautical miles. You have been out at sea this long, blah, blah, blah. And it sort of rammed it all home to you.
I bet, yeah.
Because it was just daily routine by that time. And to have it actually taken out of perspective. I'm making it sound a lot more adventurous than it was.
Oh, no, totally. It's adventurous. No one's disputing that.
But as I said, you've got the guys rowing now at the moment across. Now, that is something else. I don't think I could do that. But from a sailing perspective, and sailing's been my thing, it ticked all the boxes. Having the supplies dwindling was interesting.
Yeah.
As I said about the fresh water, we no longer had the water maker.
No.
So we relied on the water tanks. So we had two big fresh water tanks, several jerry cans of water, which were all pontoon water. So you wouldn't want to drink it without boiling it.
Mm.
And then we had loads of bottled water. And the plan was that no matter what happened, the bottled drinking water was sufficient without anything else to get us there. The supplies ran low.
As they would.
More than anticipated. Nobody could understand why the drinking water just went. I mean, not drinking water, the fresh water just went.
Yeah.
And we looked for leaks, couldn't find any. So the other thing was perhaps there was more usage going on than perhaps we all knew about. So that would be a classic where people would start looking at each other.
Yeah.
So we had one thought was, well, let's use the jerry cans and top up those tanks, which are now empty.
Mm.
And then the other thought was, well, actually, let's not, because if we do that, if there is some sort of leak that we don't know, it's going to start leaking again.
Mm.
If there is somebody using more water than there should be, they're going to start using it again. So we decided we would decant the water from the jerry cans into a big bottle, which we would use for cooking.
Mm.
And every time we needed to replace it, we would keep decanting it and bypass the general water.
Mm.
So from that moment on, which is, to be fair, was only about 10 days in, we did everything with salt water, everything. So you were showering with salt water. You got a bucket of mid-Atlantic water, as fresh as you can get, and you were clean, but you're always sticky.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Not a nice feeling.
Yeah. But you got used to it. And the camaraderie was really good. And I think the adventure and that things not going absolutely to book made it, really.
Oh, absolutely. If it had just been, like you say, a few weeks of gentle cruising across the Atlantic, you wouldn't have had much to say when you got back.
No.
Had a lovely time.
Exactly.
So, no, absolutely fantastic.
Because we tore out a sail.
Yes, it was hand-stitched back together, is that right?
It was. The sail we had was thrown on the boat fairly last minute, which was a downwind sail, which is downwind conditions. And it was... I think it had seen the best of its days because it was fairly sun fatigued. So there was a big and the whole thing ripped right down the center. But we had a fantastic guy on board who's an ex-deep sea saturation diver, been in the forces, this, that, and the other. And he was very good with a hand stitching. So, and we had a surgeon on board as well, a Polish surgeon. Yeah. And so they were down below, literally seaming it all back up again. They spent probably 3 days doing it, putting reinforced stitches in. And then we stuck it up. 2 hours later, bang, gone again, and in a completely different area.
Oh, so wow, okay.
It was definitely the material.
Yeah.
So after that, we just had the small white sails, which were great when it was windy anyway, but obviously very depowering when the wind wasn't there because you didn't have your secret weapon to put up.
Yeah. But I bet that gentleman was proud of his stitches holding up.
And so he should have been.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a work of art. And when it came down the second time, it nearly went underneath the boat because it falls into the water. And then you think, well, okay, you've gone underneath the boat. But actually, it can go into the rudder and jam your steering everything.
Yeah.
So there was a hell of a pressure to get that back on board. And we did. And we thought, no way are we doing that stitching again.
No.
So we were just lived without it.
Yeah.
Mainsail, it ripped at one point as well. But it was what they call on the first reef. So because we were down to two reefs a lot of the time with the strengthening wind, that was not actually taking any force. So it was like that that we arrived back in St. Lucia.
Wow. Yeah. And it's, like I say, an absolute adventure of a lifetime, Tony. What do you think you learned about yourself during that voyage?
I learned how remote we all are, really, in the size of the planet. You know, we go about our everyday lives, and our everyday lives are big and all-consuming, and so they should be. But when put against the perspective of something like that, it's hard to put it to words, really. It's it makes you, as I said earlier, makes you feel quite insignificant. The other side of it, getting on with people in a very short and sometimes a volatile environment because people are tired, they're not at their best. Cooking is always a bone of contention because people like some things, other people don't like this. Or that, to overcome those things, I think we all did quite well. And we all got off as friends. We all wanted to spend more time with each other in the social environment of the Caribbean rather than less time. And there wasn't any burning of rubber as the nearest taxi went away from the boat.
That's good. Good sign, yeah.
Yeah, so that was it, yeah. It's all about people and the vastness of the ocean. And I took those two boxes almost immediately. And getting the freshness of the water as well. One thing that did surprise me, although I've heard about it, this Sargasso weed. It's confined to the Sargasso Sea, from what I understand it. But there's been problems with it spreading. And the Sargasso Sea is fairly low in nutrients. This is what I understand from what I've heard. So when it comes outside that into more nutrient area, it expands. So you'd go across, you'd see islands of seaweed all over the place. They're not the sort of seaweed we get here. It's just you notice it. And then you get big clear patches. So it was all fascinating.
Yeah. I feel like we could just carry on talking forever, Tony. Has it been like this since you returned to Ramsey and the harbour there? What have your colleagues made of the stories you've been bringing back?
They've been fantastic because a lot of them were really interested, more so than I thought they would be. So we had a collective WhatsApp group, which is set up by our line manager, Gary Lewin, and he set that up. And everybody was onto it, and I would be able to send photographs through as well. You know, a picture of the marlin, you know, standing up in the typical fisherman's pose, just before my muscles gave out, holding it in the air for that fraction just to get the photograph.
Yeah, take it quick.
Now before it drops. But that, and then also the seas and the skies, and you could get some very very photographic moments there, and would send those over, and just general preparing fish and food. Yeah. So, yeah, they've been great. They obviously made their humorous comments back, but it kept me going, really did.
Yeah, fantastic, Tony. Well, it's, like we say, adventure of a lifetime. You're back. You must be very grateful, of course, to have been able to have that time off. What would you say to anyone who's thinking about doing something similar?
I would say if you've got your ducks in a row and it looks like you've got a chance to do it, just do it. And don't automatically think that the answer would be no. I mean, there'll be a lot of, especially in the private sector, there'll be a lot of work out there that will say, you can do it, but you're not coming back to your job because we can't let you go this long. Because I'm probably away 5 weeks in total from the prep to coming back. And I've, obviously that put pressure on my colleagues, but they were very supportive as well. So, yeah, if you've got the people around you who are keen for you to do it, you'll get it done. If it happens in reverse, then it's not so great. That's, so my advice to anybody is give the process a try, and you might find yourself pleasantly surprised.
Perfect. I think that's a great note to end on there, Tony. Is there anything else you'd like to mention? Anything we missed at all?
No. I'm just trying to think that there's anything at all. There's probably is, you know, where you'll get outside here and you think, should have said that.
I know. These questions I want to ask you. I was wondering if you'd spotted any, you know, what was the weirdest thing you'd spotted out there that you never expected to see out there in the Atlantic? Did you come across any plastic out there at all? Because we hear about
those. Masses of plastic around. No, we didn't. I mean, you hear about it.
Yeah.
There is obviously quite a bit of shipping in the Atlantic generally. If you look onto marine traffic, it looks like it's a thoroughfare.
Yeah.
You don't see them, but until you do see them, and we have one go quite close to us in this vastness. So that sort of concentrated the mind a bit. And then the other yachts, you know, they were all nearby, but not. The nearest one would be 100 miles, which in Atlantic terms is next door. That side of it, it was always reminding you of the size of what you're doing and the size of the area you're going. And you just got down to the being a team on board, and your world, although it expanded massively on the Atlantic, on the boat, it shrank. You shrank down to your duties and your washing and your, you know, by the time we'd finished washing our clothes, you'd have to beat them with a stick full of salt water. but apart from that, they were clean, but they were just a bit stiff.
Oh, Tony, it's been fascinating speaking to you. Thank you so much for coming into to Manx Radio and speaking with us.
Yeah, not at all. Thank you.
Thank you for making it to the end of the Manx Radio newscast. You are obviously someone with exquisite taste. May I politely suggest you might want to subscribe to this and a wide range of Manx Radio podcasts at your favourite podcast provider, so our best bits will magically appear on your smartphone. Thank you.